This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. The University of Dayton is hosting a conference to address what organizers call the high-risk threats to human rights, arguing these threats are presenting themselves with unprecedented urgency. The conference's keynote speakers include Black Lives Matter co-founder Opal Tometi, author and New York Times contributing opinion writer Zeynep Tufekci, and MSNBC political analyst Anand Giridharadas. I spoke earlier with some of the organizers and participants in the Human Rights Center's Social Practice of Human Rights Conference. And joining us now are the Executive Director of the Human Rights Center at the University of Dayton, Shelley Inglis. Welcome, Shelley.
Thanks, Michael.
A lecturer in the Department of Political Science and Partnership Coordinator at the Human Rights Center at the University of Dayton, Yusuf Farhat. Welcome, Yusuf.
Thanks, Michael.
And on the phone is the founder and executive director of RHIZE, that's R-H-I-Z-E, a global community that supports emerging social movements through coaching, education, and forging peer learning and solidarity networks, Aaron Mazursky. Hi, Aaron.
Hi.
Okay, let's start with just some general overview of this upcoming conference, October 1 through the 4th. It's being promoted as exploring the future of human rights as it relates to social, economic, and environmental and technological transformations in society. Just tell us a little bit about what that means, Shelley.
Thanks, Michael. The Social Practice of Human Rights Conference is a conference that we have biennially, and what it seeks to do every 2 years is to look at what are the key challenges facing the human rights movement and how do we discuss them across the lines of academics who do the type of research and scholarship and thought leadership, and practitioners like Aaron who are out in the field promoting social movements and advocacy and change. And this year, we're looking at the kinds of issues that are pushing the human rights movement into the future, into thinking about new ways of doing things, about innovating to tackle the challenges that we face in this century as opposed to the last century when the human rights movement was founded.
And Yusuf, you're a lecturer in the Department of Political Science at the university, and activism is so often associated with young people and throughout history has had a very significant place on various college campuses. So tell us about what is different about activism or engagement in human rights-oriented issues today among college-age students, when you think about another era. I mean, Vietnam comes to mind, but there's been many eras throughout history where college students have been mobilized.
Right. It's interesting you bring Vietnam because we are just about to launch a new initiative at the Human Rights Center around Vietnam. Really, we are driven by the passion of students nowadays. We see it on campus. We see it coming up with some of the climate strike that's happening all over. So most of the work that we do at the university really is in response to some of these issues that students feel very passionate about. And SPHR created that space as a conference to actually bring students from all different disciplines, from the arts, from the engineers and sciences and social sciences and humanities, to rally up around some of these issues that are important to them. And what we do really as a higher ed institution is provide a space for them to see both sides, what it looks like to be in the classroom, what faculty and researchers are doing in human rights area, and as well practitioners. That's the important part.
Is that more difficult now than you may recall just because of this? I mean, it's sort of a superficial way to describe the political climate, but we hear a lot about polarization. Mm-hmm. And you certainly see that play out on social media networks, and there are a variety of channels that people can turn to reinforce their preconceived notions about issues. Is it difficult to bring students to the table?
It is. It's not difficult to bring them to the table. Rather, it's important to have them think a little bit about what are the evidence-based research that's taking place and some at the core of the issues. So how do we kind of decrypt some of the messages we hear about in the mainstream media, and how do we actually focus on the substance, and what are the human rights issues at the core, and why do we have to think about some of these issues outside the red and blue lines and some of the polarization. So it's challenging, but it's really exciting because there's a lot of opportunities for growth and learning. And that's what at least we've been experiencing with our students.
Aaron, I'd like to get your perspective on that as well. You've had a varied career in issues related to human rights, and there are multiple movements nationally and across the globe. So I'm wondering, what are you seeing in terms of young people and their engagement?
Yeah, quite frankly, I've been incredibly inspired and motivated watching young people who are in high school, college, really mobilizing and recognizing that There's really no other way to create change but to really create more opportunities for collective action. And I think young people today are doing that in really innovative and new ways. They have new language around human rights and really understand that it's oppressive systems that are a part of a bigger picture that are really causing a lot of the human rights abuses and issues that we're seeing today. And so I actually look at young people and get a lot of hope. And I really think that they're actually on the forefront of pushing the dialogue and conversations forward to create a new vision for what we're trying to see the world as.
It seems there's no shortage of human rights issues or associated movements, Aaron. I'm wondering if you can talk about some that you are seeing affecting the most change.
Yeah, I mean, there's movements all over the world in every single country, and all of them are powerful in different and exciting ways. I would say in the U.S., we obviously have some really exciting movements that are really changing the conversation. I think that the climate justice movement with new groups like the Sunrise Movement are creating a lot of new conversations. They're the ones that helped originate the idea of the Green New Deal, and now it's all over the presidential race, which is really exciting. You've got young people in Sudan who, you know, just saw a dictator fall after 35 years. And you've got groups in Thailand that are, you know, fighting for democracy under a new military dictatorship. And so you're really seeing new victories in India around gender equality, LGBT rights. And so, you know, in the face of what we're seeing as really a trend in democratic institutions kind of failing in a lot of ways, you're seeing movements really rise up to that challenge. And most of them are really driven by young people.
Shelley, we heard Aaron, as one of her examples, offer up the Green New Deal. And that strikes me as an example of something that is so easily dismissed by many people because it's been so politicized. And it seems that the main driver of that is our access to so much information and so many varied perspectives. So I want to talk about social media and its good and its bad influence on the type of conversation you're going to be facilitating at this conference. I mean, social media is like this unprecedented tool for organizing and bringing people together, but it does also provide immediate access to disinformation. It can provide immediate access to a counterpoint to reinforce whatever view you feel like you want to maintain, regardless of what's presented. And those positions may not be fair to the activists, or conversely, it could allow activists to misinform on their own. So can you just talk a little bit about the impact of the opportunities provided by social media to influence activism and human rights efforts?
This is one of the key themes that we're actually addressing at the conference. It is the role of new technologies, new media in human rights, both as threats to human rights. The human rights movement has been taking strong action to try and understand how new media, data, privacy, artificial intelligence, and new forms of technology can really impose on human rights, and how we need to use a human rights framework to think about how we develop these new medias and regulate them and new technologies. But it's also unleashed the kind of social movements and the capacity of people to form bonds and to come around issues that they share regardless of if they're in the same space and time, and to mobilize movements. And we've seen that that has been a really important basis for this new form of young people and social mobilization across the world. So it's really a balance of how do we both use human rights as a framework to understand and think about regulation and placing these new forms of media and technology in a framework that promotes human rights and secures people's rights, but also how we use it as a tool, how it becomes an effective advocacy tool. When you talk about the Green New Deal and going into polarization, I wanted to just note that many of the ideas that are stemming from this understanding that we can't just address climate change without addressing our economic system, that we can't just address social security without thinking about our taxation, that we cannot address things in isolation anymore. This is really what the transformation around our economic and environmental and social system is about. And while the Green New Deal is a particularly American phenomenon, there has been global discourse around how we do this for a while. And in 2015, member states or countries of the United Nations came together and formed an agenda called the Sustainable Development Agenda, which tries to do just that. So while the Green New Deal specifically addresses political questions in the United States, there is a global agenda and global frameworks out there that reinforce many of these efforts, these goals to move towards not only being environmentally friendly, but also ensuring jobs for the future, also ensuring people have the kind of health and social security, and addressing climate as well as peace and justice, which is really essential for us to live in a future where everybody thrives. So I just wanted to mention that while we have polarization in the United States, it's always useful to look at what others are doing as well and figure out that our discourse is not necessarily around red and blue, but rather that we have challenges across the world that we really need to think in an integrated manner about how we address them.
Well, I guess I would just follow up with a wonder about, we live in a political climate today that the America First ideals are dominant and in charge at the federal level right now. And so there's not a whole lot of attention necessarily, or maybe not a lot of consideration given to some of the issues across the globe by rank and file Americans who are engaged on social media. We heard Aaron earlier also reference as an example of some human rights stuff around the world, a change of leadership in the Sudan. Well, I don't see a whole lot of conversations about that in my Twitter feed, and maybe I'm following the wrong people, but I know that Justin Trudeau, the Prime Minister of Canada, is trending right now because of some blackface issues that he was in, and that's easier to digest, right? That's easier to take an opinion on. How do we cut through some of this noise and get people to understand what's important on a global scale? Not to dismiss the blackface things, that's not what I mean, but I'm just saying, like, there are deeper issues that you might have to think a little harder before you take a position on.
I think it's a challenge, obviously, because people can grasp on what the meaning of particular issue of the day without really thinking about what is underlying that issue and how do we seek to address it. And I think we go from issue to issue so quickly because of social media and other forms of media and technology that we're not taking the time to look at how do we make the change that we want to see. I do think that over time we've seen an increase in understanding, which is also what Aaron was getting at, that we have systems and policies and processes in place, both at the global level, global institutions through which the United States has been a very active player and, in fact, been a huge beneficiary of much of that global order, as well as domestic systems in place, and that there are challenges that we need to face together and that we cannot do it alone. The United States simply cannot address climate change, simply cannot address migration, simply cannot address many economic issues and trade without engaging with the rest of the world. It's just not possible. So we need to be honest with ourselves. And sometimes that requires us, I think, and there's a lot of discourse going on right now, turning off the phone a bit, looking away from the next thing on our Twitter feed and thinking about, okay, what is it that we can do effectively as Americans to make the change? It is not unheard of in history that the United States has been able to put forward new ways of doing things that have since greatly improved many people's lives and benefited overall the globe.
Aaron, I'm wondering if just this sheer number of issues that we could raise right now during this conversation and offer some analysis on the impact that it's having or the success that it's having, the failures that it's facing. Is there a sense of fatigue that has a negative impact on people's willingness to get engaged?
I think there is, but I would say that the fatigue isn't necessarily about the issues. I mean, I do think that we live in a crazy media environment where every single day we're just accosted by more and more injustices and absurdities. But I would say that the fatigue actually comes more from people not seeing where they can make an impact. And I hear so many times, again and again, what can I do beyond just, you know, making phone calls for elected officials or knocking on doors? And I think one of the things that my organization really helps promote is new kinds of organizing and really thinking about how do we engage people creatively through different types of actions. Because at the end of the day, where we're seeing successes is with movements that are really focused on changing culture, changing narrative, changing understanding, which social media helps to build. But at the end of the day, then underlying all of that is how do we build relationships? And relationships get built through action. They get built through training and learning and developing new skills around activism. I think a lot of people think that anyone can do activism, and anyone can do activism, but the way that people are able to sustain this work is through deeper understandings of how to do actions, the systems of power that govern our world and how people perceive that, all of those different things. And so there is actually an art and a science to movement building. And that's what we really try to kind of get at the bottom of, is really help educate people around those things. And I believe that if more people had a greater sense of ownership over what they can do rather than relying on politicians or large advocacy organizations to tell them what to do, then we would see a lot more people sustaining the action that we've seen, especially since the 2016 election.
And Youssef, what are you seeing in that respect when it comes to young people and any potential impact of fatigue on them?
Yeah, I mean, we see it every day because it's becoming harder and harder to communicate certain messages. And honestly, Michael, we have to dig a little bit deeper on some of these issues. I mean, you brought up the feed and what pops up in your feed. Algorithm is playing a role in our lives right now, and dealing with artificial intelligence and the depth of how algorithms are controlling some of the news and aspects that you're being exposed to is very critical. So our hope from the conference really is to actually bring those conversations up in a very critical way and provide practitioners and activists and advocates to really reflect in a very critical way on some of these campaigns and actions and some of these technologies that are driving us. So one of our keynote speakers is Zeynep Tufekci, who is a Turkish author and scholar in North Carolina. And she's wrote Twitter and Tear Gas, which is reflective really on the role of Twitter in the Arab Spring and later movement. And it's really a momentum time because currently she's in Hong Kong and covering some of the movements that's taking place there. It's very important to take a kind of step back and see what has worked, what hasn't worked, and how we can move forward from here in a way that actually changed the human rights movement and moves us in a direction that we have new ways of organizing, like Aaron is talking about.
And this is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. We're talking today about the upcoming Human Rights Conference that will be held at the Human Rights Center at the University of Dayton. And we are joined today by the Executive Director of the Human Rights Center at the University of Dayton, Shelley Inglis. We've got a lecturer in the Department of Political Science and Partnership Coordinator at the Human Rights Center at the University of Dayton, Youssef Farhat. And on the phone is the Founder and Executive Director of RISE, that's RHIZE. Her name is Erin Mazursky. So I want to talk, I don't want to project upon the people who are going to be attending the conference or suggest that I know anything about them, but I'm making an assumption, I guess, that the people who will show up to learn about this they're engaged people, or they want to learn more about certain issues or how they can better affect change related to whichever subject matter interests them. But there is this growing phenomenon of, you know, the keyboard warrior, you know, the somebody who has really strong, intense opinions about stuff, and they only go as far as retweeting something or maybe posting something and flaming on Facebook, but they're not out in the streets or they're not doing anything physically to bring about the change that they seem to want. So I'm wondering, how do you reach those folks? And I'll start with you, Aaron. The people who are close to being actual activists but haven't quite gotten out of the office chair yet?
Armchair activism is—it's not new, but it definitely takes on new forms in today's day and age. And you know, the way that we tend to think about it is, you know, who are the people you want to really try and reach? People who first who can be changed, you know, and who can be shifted. And I think those people do play a role in kind of helping to change narrative, and it's not necessarily a bad thing, although in the world of algorithms, as we've said, we tend to be in our own little echo chambers of people who agree with us. But I think I do think that the more we can find ways to build relationships and help people kind of, yeah, get off their computers, get out of their armchairs, and really talk to one another, where the conversation starts. And that's where community gatherings are really inspiring. There, right after the election, there were a few different civic health conversations that happened, and it was just, you know, people getting together, playing board games, but also talking about kind of like, what do they want to see for the world? And I think it's in those kinds of exchanges that you see a person in 3D, and, you know, you're able to really connect with them. And so it's definitely a challenge. But I think the more spaces we can create for that, the more we wind up activating the people who, you know, certainly agree and want to see change, but, you know, don't need to take the activism an extra step.
Michael, I just want to mention that this is happening at the University of Dayton, and in the year I have been in Dayton, I have seen actually the opposite, that Dayton is a place where people are not in the office, but extremely engaged in their communities on many levels and on many different issues. I'm not only proud of the faculty at UD who not only teach, but also apply their teaching to actual projects in the community, to serve in the community, to seek food justice, to look at climate justice, sustainability, to respond to the kind of gun violence that we've seen recently in Dayton, and to address a history of, frankly, racial disparity that continues to impact maternal mortality and other really key issues for the daily lives of Daytonites. So I think the University of Dayton is a place where people can come and see that people actually apply in their local community their beliefs, their value system, and their activism. And whether it gets to the national level is another question. But if you zoom in on where we are right now in the Midwest, at least my experience is, and I'm sure it's true for Cincinnati as well, that there is a tremendous amount of sense of capacity and empowerment to go out and to help the community, to serve the community, and to discuss the key issues that the community is facing.
You talked about some issues just then that various faculty members from UD may find themselves physically involved in. And in the promotional materials for this upcoming conference that you're hosting, Shelley, you were quoted as saying that it will address high-risk threats and, quote, hopefully reinvigorate sustainable movements and innovative methods that not only counter these threats, but also build a better future of human rights, even if it means, to quote Pope Francis, going against the grain. Can you explain what the urgent high-risk threats are?
Well, some of them you've actually just been talking to us about. They are a global trend in authoritarianism and a revival of nativism and nationalism that rejects the other in many different ways. They're the climate crisis, and the climate crisis really linked to an economic global crisis that is fusing a kind of inequality, a deep inequality, and sort of a challenging our middle-class structures around the world. We have the technology dimension, which you went into quite specifically, that is really asking us to think differently, but also to understand that we need tools to regulate and to be able to ensure the relationship building despite the role of new technology and media in our lives. So all these things are big trends that look quite challenging and meta, but also play out on a day-to-day basis in everybody's lives. And so we need to learn how to tackle them. And as the human rights movement, we've been rather good and successful at showing violations, discussing when children are in cages at the border and how that's a violation. What we've been less good in talking about with our communities is, okay, what kinds of solutions does the human rights framework get us towards? What kinds of changes do we want to see that ensure violations in the end are less, and that we're less focusing on the horrific things happening and more focusing on this, the pathway and the framework for change? So that's the effort here. And Pope Francis really asked the community, and as you know, UD is a Catholic and Marianist university, to go against the grain. In other words, both to stand up to the direction of society right now, which is going against our values, but also to think innovatively and creatively about how we do things differently.
And we've been talking for about 24 minutes, and my goodness, I feel like 36, 37 different threats or scary situations have just been touched upon. So good luck with your human rights conference. I wish you the best with that. I want to thank from the University of Dayton, Shelley Inglis and Youssef Farhat, and from the organization RISE, Aaron Mazursky. I appreciate all of you coming down and chatting with us.
Thanks
Michael. We hope you'll come.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.